Hi, my name is Mike Gibb, and I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'll be moderating today's webinar on the biggest mistakes that collection agencies tend to make. You know, I coach my kids in soccer and hockey, and one of my many, many sayings is, we never lose. We either win or we learn. And I guess today is intended to be a discussion about how collection agencies can learn from one another to help their businesses grow and succeed. We're fortunate to have a panel of experts with us today who will share their stories and insights with us. This webinar is being generously sponsored by InterPros. You'll get the chance to hear from them a little later in our program. I want to take a quick second and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the Army industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the Army industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use, and it's a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it has to offer. Let me tell you a little bit now about today's speakers. LaDonna Bowling is the Vice President of Special Operations at Contract Callers, Inc. in Augusta, Georgia, responsible for training development and client relations. She has decades of experience in first and third party collections, focusing on utilities, telecom, and medical. She's very active with the Georgia Collectors Association, a member of Inside Arms Compliance Professionals Forum, and is a certified instructor for ACA International. She also holds a Credit and Collection Compliance Officer designation, as well as the International Fellowship of Certified Collection Executives designation. LaDonna is the 2016 recipient of the ACA International's Kurt Swirsky Award for Outstanding Leader in the Collection, Credit and Collection Industry. She believes it's her mission to educate the public on the importance of the collection industry, and has stated numerous times that the collection industry is one of the most underappreciated industries in the nation. Mike Hiller is the Vice President of Collections for American Profit Recovery. He joined APR more than a decade ago as an entry-level employee. He is a licensed collection manager in Michigan and serves as a subject matter expert for the Department of Licensing and Regulatory Affairs. Mike Frost is the Chief Compliance Sales Officer and General Counsel for CBE Companies in Cedar Falls, Iowa. He holds a bachelor's degree in political science from the University of Northern Iowa and a Juris Doctorate from Drake University Law School. Frost joined CBE Companies in 2004 and manages various teams of professionals, including sales, marketing, legal, quality assurance, regulatory compliance, legislative affairs, litigation defense, corporate governance, and enterprise risk. He also changes all the stuff in the vending machine, too. Mike is an active ACA member and has chaired several committees. He is currently serving his fourth year and second term as a member of ACA International's Board of Directors. Mike received ACA Members Attorney Program Designation Award in 2014. He's also earned ACA's Fellow and Scholar designations, was named Unit Leader of the Year in 2013 as President of the Iowa Collectors Association, and received a Judicial Advocacy Award in 2018. Michael O'Mara has been a professional in the collections industry since 1990 and has held virtually every job the industry offers. Michael's been active in ACA and Washington Collectors Association, is a past president of the WCA and his local bar association. He's achieved several designations offered through ACA, including the 3CO and IFCCE, and obtaining his scholar and fellow degrees through ACA. He's the recent recipient of the Kirshner Instructor Achievement Award. Michael has been active in several ACA committees and is committed to the protection and growth of the industry and our association. The format for today's webinar will be a panel discussion. We encourage everybody to submit questions, and we'll get to them when the discussion has concluded. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. This event is being recorded, and a recording will be made available in the coming days on AccountsRecovery.net. Finally, this event is an audio-only event. If you're not seeing anything on your screen, you're not missing anything. So with that, I want to launch into today's discussion. So we've segmented our discussion into a number of different areas where our panelists seem to see collection agencies make the most common mistakes or most frequently make mistakes. And the first topic we're going to talk about are collection letters. So with that, LaDonna, maybe you can walk us through what are some of the common mistakes you see being made by collection agencies when sending letters.
Well, thank you, Mike. And I'd like to say I'm happy to be here with all these mics. But I think that one of the biggest mistakes is not following the regulatory requirements for the wording of the letters. There's five things that we have to put on the validation notice, and one of those is telling the consumer how to dispute the debt. There have been some lawsuits where agencies have changed the wording around, I guess, to make it sound more friendly, and that's gotten them into trouble on the legal side. Not knowing what all the requirements are from the state level, because there are several states who have very specific requirements as to what goes on their letters, and you have to follow them to a T. I think those are the biggest mistakes.
Yeah, this is Mike Hiller, Donna. You're absolutely right. I mean, what we've been seeing is, you know, the old standbys of agency name instead of the DBA, right? So register a DBA, use a DBA, especially if you want your name viewable in that window. Otherwise, just put your return address. Consumer account number, you know, that's been a mainstay for the past year or so. It's easier for mail returns and those types of things, but our letter vendors have a lot of creative ways of sorting mail now, so it's not such a concern. But don't put an account number on there. Lots of lawsuits out of the second. And I see 809A, 3-5 as the next big thing, and that's our initial communications. We thought it was safe harbor because the FDCPA outlines it fairly clearly. What they outline clearly, however, is a bunch of contradictory lines. So for us, you know, instead of putting notify us, we're putting notify us in writing, which is consistent with the rest of the language in 809A. Instead of putting if you request, well, how is it requested? You know, what venue, you know, we're putting, you know, put receive your written communication. So a little more clear and a lot more consistent.
Yeah.
And this is Michael O'Meara. I might just add that we've seen a pretty significant uptick in agencies getting sued over how they're identifying the original creditor as well. So make sure you understand who the original creditor is, especially if you're in the medical field. If you've got a doctor and a clinic and a hospital, you need to make sure you identify those folks. Whoever the original creditor is, don't abbreviate. Make sure that it is crystal clear. A lot of agencies have problems with a field length where they can only put in so much in a given field to identify the creditor. That can cause problems if there is abbreviations and the like there. So make sure you take a look at how you're identifying your creditors.
Yeah, and especially if you're doing work for some debt buyers where you have current creditors, original creditors, all that can get a little bit daunting when trying to figure out what to put on your letters.
Yeah, this is Frosty. I guess I would echo kind of what the presenters are saying so far and just add that, you know, I do a lot of collection letter reviews from a MAP perspective, member attorney program at ACA. And while it may not be required under insurance anymore, there's still a lot of agencies that continue to have, members review those letters to ensure that they're in compliance with the most up-to-date regulations and up-to-date case law that's out there. And I would just say by looking at a lot of them, a lot of times what I see are things that people are throwing into the letters that just don't need to be there. So kind of like what you said about making sure that you're getting the right information, but also don't put too much in. You don't need a logo from another trade association in your letter. What's that going to do? Does it benefit you in any way? Does it tell the consumer anything? Probably not. You probably shouldn't have it there because it just calls into question, what is it? And it's not customarily something that you would traditionally put in a collection letter. I see a lot of that. I see a lot of issues related to links that may be in your collection letter to drive people to payment portals. You have to go to those payment portals and ensure that those payment portals are compliant with the FDCPA. If they're not, you're subjecting your entire payment portal to a letter review. Kind of simple things like that, and I think LaDonna made the point that people are trying to be kind, which is very good. I mean, that's what the agency wants to drive to, is we want to be respectful and to consumers, and we're trying to do the right thing, and we're now getting called out for that in court. Keep them basic, keep them directed at the disclosures that are required, as I think Mike Hiller pointed out. Stay to the letter of the law, get the letters out, and hopefully it generates a contact. If nothing else, it generates adherence to the specific regulation and nothing more. But they are a cesspool of opportunities for plaintiff's counsel to try to file class action suits, and that's the one thing everybody's trying to avoid today from a cost perspective.
Well, Frosty, you started out on the at the beginning talking about what you do, you know, as far as letter reviews. Even though the insurance requirement is not there anymore, there are some states that require that you have your letters reviewed by an attorney. And I think it's just a good business practice regardless, because, you know, laws are always changing. And despite how much we try to stay on top of compliance and laws and such, you know, we might miss something because, you know, I can't interpret things the way an attorney would. So I would rather, you know, someone who is well versed in that field review our letters to make sure that they are correct and followed, you know, to the letter of the law. Because I know that there was a lawsuit where I think it was Rodriguez versus Northland Group. One part of it was they had added to their letters, "We look forward to hearing from you." And even though they weren't found at fault for that, but they still had to, you know, pay for the defense of that statement. So I think attorney review is critical.
I would agree, but I would add one thing to that. I've seen the industry over the 20 years I've been in it go from agencies absolutely not willing to share a single thing with a competitor to agencies being very open and sharing a lot of information with competitors. Sometimes it's not bad to not only bounce single letter issues off of attorneys and have them do the reviews, but it's also good to bounce them off somebody that you trust in the industry. If there's another agency that practices either in your marketplace or in a different one, and you're willing to share those letters or get an insight on what they're doing, I think it's good to collaborate in those areas too, to say, you know, how are you guys complying with this issue, or how are you dealing with this in your letter? And sometimes you'll even get agencies to share letters across each other so you can see what's working and what's not, and how best to serve your customer. So I think that's been a trend that we've seen in the industry, is a lot more openness. And I would recommend that to all the listeners as well. If you can find somebody that you trust in the industry that may be a competitor that you can share some information and get some from them, it's always a good thing to do as well.
Yeah, I think that's sound advice because, you know, I do a lot of letter jobs as well. And it constantly amazes me how many of my clients will say, "Well, I think our letters are pretty much bulletproof," and I'll go in and review them. And not only are there problems with the letters from a legal perspective, but there are simply typos, sentences that are not well constructed. So I think the more eyes you get on these letters, the better, because you need somebody who didn't write the letter, who doesn't look at the letter every day, to come in from a fresh perspective and make sure it says what you intended it to say. Because a lot of times, I think Mike Ross will agree, it's very rare that you get a bunch of letters from a client and you don't find a couple of letters that don't have problems with them. I don't think I've ever done a letter job where I don't think I've improved markedly the letters in some way or alleviated or found a potential problem.
Yeah, one mistake we made in the past, and I was trying, I guess, to save on having to create, you know, another letter. We had on our letters, because we credit report for some of our clients, it said, "This account may be reported to a credit bureau." And when I had them reviewed by an attorney, they were like, "Well, this is just too ambiguous. Either it's going to report or it's not." And I hadn't looked at it from that perspective, but I thought, you know, I was covering all bases with the phrase of "this account may be reported."
I'm curious, Michael Amir, you raised an issue in your remarks when you were talking about sort of limits on, you know, field length and how many characters you can put in a field as it relates to sort of taking that information, including in a collection letter. If you've got a situation where you've got more characters in the field than you've got room for, how do you advise agencies deal with that?
Well, you know, we can put men on the moon is what I tell my clients. So we can certainly figure out some way to do this, either through your letter vendor, if you use one, or through your software folks at home. But if you've got, for instance, you know, Dr. Sana Yamayama at the, you know, Bethesda Clinic, and you abbreviate that Dr. Satan, you're going to have a problem. And I've seen cases and more an increasing amount of volume of cases where they are arguing that and alleging in a lawsuit that you have confused the least sophisticated consumer by failing to adequately identify the original creditor by name. An abbreviation won't do it. So that's a technical problem that you just have to kind of work through. But, you know, you can do it. I've had several clients initially tell me it can't be done. And, you know, with IT, as everyone knows, it can't be done until you need to do it. And then, of course, anything can be done.
And this is Frosty. I would just agree, add one thing to that is I've seen a lot of letter reviews, especially in the medical field, where you have potentially, you know, 5, 10, 15 different prospective creditors because of the way that the hospital systems are set up. And I've seen agencies actually put in like maybe the client that has the largest balance amount, but then wants to couple all of those accounts together and puts a client bar at the top to identify the client. But then what do you put in that? You can't put 15 clients in there, right? Because it doesn't have enough space, to Michael's point. So what I've seen is people put in ABC Hospital and various others, and then they try to break it out at the bottom. So I think you got to be very cautious on how you approach that issue. And if you don't have enough variables to put all of those client names in it, maybe it's removing that client box at the top, and maybe it's identifying in a breakout at the bottom. There's different ways to skin that cat, but you have to look at it in totality to understand. You can't put it in various others because it doesn't identify fully who the client is, and it could be 15. The other way to do that is to send out individual letters so there's less confusion. But obviously, when you're trying to save expense, that's not something you want to do, especially if those are all rolled up and merged into one debtor account for your system. So that's another example of an issue that you would look at from a collection letter perspective and figure out how do you work through some of those field restriction issues.
Yeah, and speaking of abbreviating fields, I've also seen agencies where they are abbreviating the fields related to the amounts owing. For instance, instead of saying principal balance or just principal, they will abbreviate it as prince, which is okay. I think even the least sophisticated consumer can figure out what prince is, but they would go down and all of a sudden you're seeing a C/CST, which of course we in the industry could probably look at and say, oh, that's probably court costs. But again, what is the least sophisticated consumer going to take that to mean? They probably don't know. So be careful about your headers on your letters to make sure that you're not, that there's no way that anybody could be confused about what this term means. If you're saying court costs, then say court costs. Don't abbreviate it into some kind of strange anagram or whatever those are called, CIA.
So let me ask you attorneys this. How do you feel about QBR codes on letters, you know, where the consumer scans it and it goes direct to a link or a payment site? How do you feel about those?
Can they view it from the outside of the letter?
Yes.
Yeah, that's a problem. Because if somebody has access to that information, then you're potentially, I mean, that's the old Douglas line of cases. But if you can access it internally in the letter, not externally from the letter through the envelope window or anything like that, as long as that link, whatever site they go to, is FDCPA compliant, which is kind of a point I made earlier on a collection letter review, those are probably okay. The problem is if you have somebody that has capability to scan that information and can get to it without opening the letter, if it's not addressed to them, or if it is addressed to them as the wrong person, then you're just, it's a third party disclosure type issue.
Yeah, and it depends on what that Q reader is gonna show whoever is looking at it. I don't know if anybody's ever downloaded the app onto their phone, the Q reader phone, but the early iterations of these letters with these codes would tell you everything you needed to know about the consumer. It would tell you the consumer's balance and sometimes even who the money was owed to. Nowadays, letter vendors are much more circumspect in the information they put there just to make it easier for them to do mail returns. But you've got to be very careful about what's going to show up there. And I agree with Mike that it's potentially problematic. And if you can avoid it, you should.
Good. Thank you.
Excellent. Well, at this point, I just want to pause our discussion briefly, and I'd like to invite Aaron Ryder from Interpro to say a few words. Aaron?
Thanks, Mike. And thanks to all the panelists today, LaDonna and all the other Michaels. Interpro is actually really excited to sponsor this webinar topic because we work so hard to protect our customers from exposure related to their software and their hardware, whether it be auditing certifications or automated processes, including the templates that, that actually touch the letters that you guys are really focused on. As the panelists are discussing today, there are many opportunities to standardize process or consumer-facing language that protects businesses from legal actions. And the more opportunities to leverage modern database structures and build compliant templates into software or remove human interactions from repeatable actions entirely, the better, in our opinion. At Interpros, we consider ourselves a service company that happens to make world-class software platform for debt recovery. So long-term relationships and mutually aligned goals are what make us successful. And as new industry requirements or insights come to light, our customers receive updates and upgrades to the platform to keep pace, usually on a monthly basis. Interpros is entirely devoted to supporting the debt recovery market. It's all we do, and we're really great at it. So for all of our customers who are attending this call, thank you again for your business. And if you're looking to modernize, to leverage new technologies as they arise, or looking for a better relationship with your software provider to feel supported, give us a call or check us out at interpros.com. It's interprose.com. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you, Aaron, and thanks to Interpros for your continuing efforts to support the education and betterment of the ARM industry. I know we're all a little better off today because of it. Thank you. Moving on to our next topic, I wanted to spend a few minutes talking about disputes. Mike Hiller, maybe you can talk about some of the best ways for collection agencies to manage dispute investigations, communications, and the overall handling of disputes.
Yeah, so thanks, Blake. I mean, as far as the dispute investigation, review it with your eyes open. I mean, seriously, something meaningful, not just a rubber stamp, more than likely you're going to be okay. But when you do nothing, I mean, that's when it's pretty obvious in my approximation. So for the letters, disputes, the re-disputes, right, the endless barrage of repeated disputes, things like that. I mean, as far as communications, so your collectors are on the phones. The mistake, back to your title here, the mistakes, is not using and improving scripts. I mean, that's a huge mistake. You know, you should be able to develop scripts that can be used on most every call. What we say is they should be adhered to plus or minus 90% of the time. I mean, there's going to be some ad lib, but it's not 15, 20 years ago when it's show me the phone and I'll show you what I can do. And if you can think fast on your feet, then you're going to be successful. I mean, how are you compliant without some type of systematic progression of that call? So the other thing I'll add with regards to communication is, you know, when your clients come to you and ask for, you know, what you say to consumers on the phone, what the heck do you give them, you know, if you don't have scripts? And I can tell you that we've had several clients now who are scooping up these rats from a sinking ship that is the CFPB, but scooping up CFPB officers, and that's the first thing they're asking for. I mean, they're asking for things like scripts. It is still the CFPB, right? They didn't spend $9 million to change it to the BCFP.
No, actually, I think they're gonna keep it at the CFPB. Actually,
yeah, they're not gonna spend the $9 million. Okay, so the CFPB, but in any event, you know, these officers are leaving the CFPB. And they're getting scooped up by some larger organizations, and they're heading up compliance departments, and they're expecting you'd be able to provide these things. The other thing with regards to communications specifically, and it's kind of a dead horse situation, but another mistake is not recording all your calls. I mean, there's still shops out there that don't record calls or don't record every calls. I think it's a huge mistake. With regards to disputes and communications, regardless of how the communications are coming at you, phone calls or letters, I think this is an area where we can be proactive. You know, unlike the letters, you know, where a lot of it's reactive, right? You got a year's worth of letters out there, and then there's something that comes out of New Jersey or New York, and now you got a year's worth sitting out there. I think the communications more directly, and the disputes that are dispute communications, you could be proactive. So be proactive where you can. And, you know, really that your audience here has got to determine for themselves, you know, what areas, you know, they can improve on. But as Polonius said, brevity is the soul of wit. So I'll leave it there.
I think it comes down to training, you know, ensuring that your staff know the differences and the requirements for addressing direct, indirect disputes, written disputes, verbal disputes, you know, having robust policies and procedures, and then auditing yourself to see that you are following these things. You know, one of the things that we've tried here, we implemented this about 6 months ago, we have a dispute resolution team because, you know, our collectors are trained, you know, if consumer talks dispute or we're getting written communication, they know what to do. We found that there was some margin for error in our follow-up on these disputes. So we have a small staff of three that do nothing but work dispute accounts. You know, after we've sent validation, you know, research it, these people, collectors reach back out to the consumers to, you know, talk about, you know, resolving the account. You know, we investigated your dispute. We, you know, sent you the results and, you know, how do you want to take care of it? Or in some situations, you know, just, you know, all efforts exhausted on the account, but we're just following up on them. And this team is trained to specifically handle these, and they're pretty much paying for themselves with the risk that they're mitigating and the revenue that they're generating off of the dispute accounts, if that makes any sense.
Well, and you can take it from a guy who does a fair amount of FDCPA, FCRA defense work. This is, I think, by far and away the number one area where agencies fall down. Speaking of training, you know, they might train their collection staff, but they don't do a terribly good job, in my experience, of training their admin staff, or whatever you want to call it, the folks that are handling these letters in day in and day out, to understand that, you know, sometimes you're going to get a dispute, sometimes you're going to get a validation request, sometimes you're going to get a request for proof, sometimes you're going to get some kind of offer in that, and sometimes you're going to get it all four of those things in one letter. And so sometimes you're going to have to parse and decide, what are my, you know, is this inside the validation period, outside the validation period? What are my responsibilities? What's the agency's responsibilities? If they get a dispute, and as Mike Hiller said, they conduct a good investigation, do they document that in the notes that they conducted this investigation? Do they have good written policies, procedures, and work instructions on how all this is going to go? And then, of course, when a consumer says, well, I'm not sure I owe all of that, and then just goes on and starts talking about something else, a lot of times the collectors don't mark that account as disputed, either because they weren't attuned to that and it wasn't properly reinforced. And believe you me, you got to be talking about marking these files as disputed on oral disputes all the time, very often, at least once a month, talking, reminding your collectors that they've got to report these accounts as disputed. Because if you're recording and they give any indication that they don't believe they owe the debt or any portion of the debt, and it wasn't immediately marked as disputed, you've got a major problem on your hands. So you've absolutely got to nail this stuff down. And we as an industry have got to do a better job you know, handling disputes, handling requests for validation and the like.
Agreed.
And a lot of collectors feel somehow that they don't want to mark the account as disputed, especially if it's a ridiculous dispute or there's no reasoning behind the dispute whatsoever. They somehow feel like the consumer is getting over on them personally or on the system, gaming the system. And you've got to get that out of their heads. They can't be resistant to the idea that we're going to mark these accounts as disputed, that it's not of any tangible, real benefit to the consumer. And if you don't do it, more importantly, you're basically just offering to cut a $1,000 check plus attorney's fees to all those folks that that are doing this. And of course, there's a lot of call baiting out there where consumers have been coached by attorneys to basically obfuscate the fact that they've disputed the debt, to confuse the collector so that they don't mark the account as disputed. And then, of course, there are other less scrupulous attorneys out there that are sending in blank faxes. And then all of a sudden, a month later, you'll get a letter saying, you know, we faxed you this dispute a month ago. Here's the confirmation of that fax. And and you don't have any record of getting that. So you should have an empty envelope, empty fax receipt, so that every time you get something that's blank, you get an envelope with nothing in it, you get a fax with nothing to it. You document that fact in an empty fax folder, so that when these attorneys come, asking for money, you can say, well, we did get a fax that day, and here it is. It's blank. That will keep you out of some trouble as well.
Or cancel your fax number.
Bingo.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, let's move on to our next topic, voicemails. Wondering what the panel thinks, whether or not collection agencies should be leaving voicemails, and if they are, there's a couple of different options out there. Is there one that's a better option than the other?
Yeah, everybody's going to jump at this one, right? This is Frost. I would say for agencies that are leaving messages, the vast majority of them that I know that are leaving messages are leaving the Zortman style message, where it's just a very basic 6 second or less message that identifies the company and the callback number. Doesn't identify who the consumer is or anything like that. We know that case went through, I think it started in Minnesota. Michael Clutho, I think, had that case. And it kind of spread across the country a little bit, started to garner some traction. So a lot of agencies moved down that path versus the old FODI style message. FODI also created some issues because it was a pre-recorded message. So there's a TCPA element to that too. So Zortman move was a really good move on a couple of different fronts. What we saw earlier in 2017, or in late 2017 in September, was a case called Hart versus Credit Control out of the 11th Circuit. It was an 11th Circuit decision that found that a Zortman style message was actually a communication under FDCPA. So those that I know of that are leaving messages throughout the United States are selecting to not leave messages at all in the 11th Circuit. But are leaving the Zortman style message outside of that circuit. That's just kind of what I've seen from an overall perspective, what's kind of leading the charge in the industry is kind of a norm. I have seen a lot of agencies that have just altogether said, they've conducted internal business analysis to understand what their callback rates were, what their investment curve was it worth the actual risk, and have just decided not to leave them at all. Very few companies that I'm aware of are leaving a FODI message. There probably are some still out there doing that, but it is important to look at the state regs, look at the case law that's in a specific jurisdiction to determine if you should continue down that path or not.
Yeah, I guess it depends on how much risk you're willing to take.
Excellent. Anybody else want to weigh in on voicemails?
Yeah, it's interesting. That you mentioned, a client looking at the numbers, right? So from an entirely revenue-driven perspective, does it make sense? And we found the opposite. What we would say is, should agencies leave voicemails? Well, for us, you might as well say, should agencies send letters? I mean, it's equally as rhetorical of a question for us. And by rhetorical, I mean silly. It makes a big difference in our contacts, number of contacts, these types of things that really drive the revenue perspective. But I would invite everyone to do you know what kind of traction you get from leaving messages? And if you don't, then find out. If you're not leaving messages, then I would run some statistically significant sample sizes in the opposite direction to see if it does make a difference or not.
So, Mike, do y'all leave messages or not?
We do. We leave the Zortman message. We have some parameters that we lay out, though. We don't leave it on every single phone number that we find through, skip tracing or otherwise. We're pretty conservative. If it's from the client or if it's been verified as the consumer, then we're leaving it. But if it's unverified, then we're not leaving it. But think about this. The type of individual who would hear that message and then call you back, that's who you want to be talking to anyway.
Because we stopped leaving messages in 2011, and we didn't really lose any inbound volume. But last year we started, partnered with a vendor for some direct drop voicemails with the Zortman, and we saw an uptick in right party contacts. But I think the key is you know, not overdoing it in any one particular area, leaving messages, every time you call the consumer, leaving a message. You know, how many messages does it take before they call you back? You know, how many no answers does it take before they see you in their caller ID and call you back? So, again, it comes down to risk mitigation and what you're willing to do.
It also, I would just add that it also kind of needs to be considered in your overall analysis as a company on your call volumes, which I know is another topic that we're going to get to in this presentation. But as you look at cases in the call volume field, most of the cases that where there's not messages left will allow higher volumes of calls than ones where there are messages left. So it may play into your strategies depending on what your shop analysis identifies as like the highest number of call attempts you make, either daily, weekly, or for the life of the actual account or phone number. So that kind of plays into it too. It's not just voicemail messages, but your overall call strategies.
Yeah, I agree. The agency should certainly be cognizant of their communication volumes and whether you're leaving Fody or Zortman on a voicemail, how that impacts your call volumes. For instance, there are a ton of states that have communication requirements or guides. For instance, here in Washington, we can only communicate with a consumer 3 times in a given week. And you've got to make sure your staff is aware that if they're leaving a message for the consumer, that is most certainly a communication. And while just showing up on their caller ID probably isn't.
Yeah, that's a good point.
If you're leaving a Zortman message, it's not considered a communication by the court. So you get into some gray area there too and create potential liabilities.
And then you throw Massachusetts into the loop, and a communication according to Massachusetts law is an attempt. I consider a no answer, not a communication, but, in Massachusetts, you can't make more than 2 within a 7-day period. So, like you said, it comes down to there's not a magic number on how many calls. You look at the, history of your shop, what was the magic number that this person called you back or they picked up their phone? That's why we have to get analytical with our data. How many calls is too many calls? I think that, what's insanity, doing the same thing over and over and getting the same results? 76 dials to a phone number and you always get a no answer. What's the point in that? If that is the consumer, they're never going to call you back. And if it's not the consumer, you're just barking up the wrong tree. You need to pull that data back and look for a better phone number. So, it's all about the analytics when it comes down to phone calls, I think.
Yeah. I completely agree with you. What do the numbers bear out? And I should have delineated earlier and I didn't, but we're working on a blended platform. So we have some manual dialing that takes place, and that's when we're leaving the Zortman, because we know which numbers are which. When we're in our more creative, TCN style dialing, we're not leaving messages, as an FYI.
I think just hitting that whole, what's the right number of attempts per day? I mean, I've had people, send me messages that are kind of over the top about, what they believe is the right number of attempts. And I think this boils down to a lot of different variables, and it can be, it goes back to the business analysis that we talked about before, because you could have a line of business, and here we work in many different segments, as many of you probably do, in the collection area, and dialing strategies in a telecom portfolio is much different than a government Department of Education type portfolio. To your point, you may be doing some manual dialing in different areas. You may be doing, strategic type dialing in other areas. And there's probably not a one size fits all where you can say, hey, never dial more than, 4 attempts a day, never dial more than 50 attempts to a given phone number if they never answer. The underlying issue is, and I've had a lot of cases, if you guys go back many years, the Tucker versus CBE case, the Carmen versus CBE case. This is back in the day when we all, as collection agencies, dialed a lot, and we didn't have a lot of parameters around them, but we created the parameters internally, created really solid policies and procedures, and we adhered to those policies and procedures. And we won cases that were 7 call attempts per day, 149 phone call attempts in 2 months. I mean, you there's not something out there that says that there's a magic number that you should or shouldn't call a number of times. But I think what everybody's saying here and what we really probably can narrow this whole issue down to is, how many numbers do you, or times do you dial to create the efficiencies or create the end in mind that you start out with a consumer when you get a new account? The end in mind is reaching the consumer, trying to find a resolution to the account. And if you can do that in 16 dial attempts, and maybe get an RPC, or it's going to take you 30 dial attempts to get that same RPC, that may be different from company and line of business, but you have to figure out what that might be and what the thresholds are and have policies and procedures around them that you can argue in court or argue to the regulators if they look at your policies and procedures and say, hey, you know, what is your perspective on this issue all the way around? And I've been at the CFPB in the past with different associations, and they ask that question. They don't have a bright line rule, although in the rulings that they, or the rule that they put out, the proposed rules a few years ago, which they've scrapped, they did have parameters around how many times we could call, and it wasn't segmented out by line of business, which is problematic for all of us. And hopefully we don't see those restrictions in the future when we can all make business decisions that make sense for the type of accounts that we have and the type of consumer that we're trying to reach.
And then think about your portfolios. Do they have an expiration date, right? If they do, that's one thing. If they don't, what we find as far as operations goes is sometimes the only thing that's going to get that consumer to pick up the phone is time. So it doesn't matter how many times you call them in the next month, it's going to take a month before they pick up the phone.
What's the panel's, what do you folks use as far as a policy on leaving messages with third parties? So the voicemail doesn't pick up, instead it's the roommate or the son or the father. Are you leaving messages with those third parties for the consumers?
No, we are not.
Is anybody?
Yes.
Yes.
Yep. Have them call me or text them and tell them to call me.
Yeah. Yeah. I just wonder, I kind of keep waiting for the other shoe to drop on this sort of line of cases where if a voicemail leaving your name and number is a communication, and in every communication we have to disclose the fact that we're a debt collector,
right?
When is some clever plaintiff's attorney going to figure out that talking to a third party and leaving your name and number is also communication, and you're specifically not disclosing the fact that you're a debt collector there? Is that a violation of the FDCPA? I don't know if I have a particular position on that, but I do suspect that someday soon we are going to get a test case on this issue.
That's my position. That's the way I thought about it, you know, was, you know, if leaving a voicemail message is communication, we're certainly talking to somebody, you know, with a communication.
Albeit indirect, but yeah, I mean, absolutely. And then where does the logical extension go? I mean, what is credit bureau reporting if not an attempt to collect a debt?
Yeah, I certainly think it would behoove agencies to start thinking about that issue, whether they are leaving messages with third parties and whether they should be or whether they want to, given the potential risk.
And then they say, what's the name of your company? And you go, you know, blah, 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 and they know
there's
a debt collector. So.
So you got a potential disclosure problem or a potential lack of disclosure problem. So in my mind, it's kind of a dangerous cat to skin.
Is that O'Mara?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not superstitious, but thanks for jinxing me.
Sorry, everybody. I knew that might make some people's days or ruin them.
No, good advice.
We're the people you can trust, Mike.
I want to move on and talk about something else that, you know, a couple of our panelists raised as areas where they see collection agencies making mistakes. So I know in advance that it's, you know, something that's going to be a worthy discussion topic, and that is the issue of client profitability, or knowing sort of when to cut a client loose because maybe you're not making any money, or not definitely not making as much as you should be making. And would love to hear comments from everybody about how they tackle this issue.
Well, I think I've raised that issue. And, you know, I come from, you know, and, well, I'm not, I guess it is us, you know, we're salespeople, or, you know, they want to sign anything. No, it's business. But is that business going to be profitable? And I think that we need to start looking before we start, you know, submitting RFPs proposals, et cetera, examining scopes of work, looking at, you know, what are our startup costs, if any, going to be, you know, at what months and at what time are we going to make a profit on this? Because really that's what it's all about. And we have some clients that are, you know, for lack of a better term, pretty high maintenance. And our sales team says, yes, we'll customize reports. And then, you know, we're paying programming costs to get, you know, customization on reports. And then, you know, the clients, they want so much from you. And then, you know, to quote a friend of mine, is the juice worth the squeeze in the long run? You know, and I know that you guys have some more feedback on this, but, you know, that just kind of gets me going.
No, LaDonna, you're absolutely right. You got to do your homework. I mean, here's the thing. If you make a mistake and you bring on a client that you shouldn't have and you're not profitable, then it's easy. You make another decision, right? You have a tough conversation with them. You tell them that, hey, look, this isn't worth working out. Neither the fees get increased or you lose the client. But as far as growth opportunities, I think that's kind of part and parcel to the client profitability. I'd say that the fastest, most painful way to grow is by another company. And then e-commerce. I mean, e-commerce is commerce.
Excellent. Okay. Well, we've got a few questions that have come in from the audience. So before I get to my discussion topics or my remaining discussion topics, I want to make sure we get a chance to address these. So if anybody else does have a question for the panel, either on anything we've discussed or maybe something different, by all means, now would be the time to enter it into your Zoom webinar control panel. Our first question is for LaDonna. Can you please expand on your statement about avoiding the use of May report to credit reporting agencies in your letters? It seems to me it wouldn't be a problem if it is true.
Right. If it's true, the attorney that reviewed our letter said that was just too ambiguous. Either it is or it isn't. And in my thought process was I didn't want to have to create another letter that says, you know, this account will be reported to the credit bureau, because we do have clients that we credit report for and clients that we don't credit report for. So I was trying to create a one-size-fits-all letter and just kind of use the term may be reported to the credit bureau, even though we don't have to notify consumers that we're reporting, except for in a couple of states. That was always a payment motivator. So he said that was too ambiguous, and if we're going to credit report, put it that we would credit report it, and if we're not going to credit report, don't mention anything about it.
Yeah, the courts really, they really just like may and can and, you know, those ambiguous terms.
Yeah.
And the ambiguity, the problem with the ambiguity probably wouldn't be where you have a creditor that you're definitely going to report for. The problem is that if the policy from the creditor or your internal policy says you never report these debts, and you send out a letter that says that it may be reported, of course, that's not true. And so that obviously is going to be problematic.
Okay, excellent. Our next question, what do you think about obtaining permission from the consumer to leave a message before doing so?
I think that's a good idea. I mean, if you can get, you know, if they know you're going to leave a message, and I think there was a court case, and you attorney fellows can help me out on this, where the collector had been in contact with the consumer numerous times talking about a settlement. And so when they called and they left a message, they didn't do the FODI or anything like that, and then a lawsuit came up, but the courts ruled in favor of the collection agency because the consumer already knew it was the collection agency that they were talking to. I probably didn't word it as eloquently as y'all would have worded it, but that was the gist of it.
Yeah, this is Frost. I would echo those remarks and also say, you know, any time, it doesn't really matter what the issue is. When you have consent from the consumer, it's always going to be an added defense to any claim that you have. And courts look very favorably on a direct consumer consent. Oftentimes, there's less emphasis on indirect consumer consent for certain things like that. But a direct consumer consent issue on voicemail would be obviously another card that you could utilize in your defense. Not sure it's absolutely necessary in the full over context, but it definitely would help.
Excellent. Our next question, even if you don't leave a message, consumers still sometimes call back from their caller ID. How best do you handle that situation?
We ask what money. Number. We ask what number did we dial, you know, if it's not showing on our caller ID, and we'll pull the account up and then say, and who am I speaking with? We try not to reveal the name of the consumer in case it's a wrong number.
Yeah, I would say give your consumer, use your consumer authentication processes, and then use your, you know, mini Miranda and debt collector disclosures once you confirm it's the consumer on all calls.
Okay, excellent. Moving on, what I'd like to do is maybe spend the last few minutes of our time today. January is right around the corner, and everybody should be, if they aren't already, sort of gearing up for tax season. So I'd like to maybe go around the panel and get some ideas or some insights into areas of the business where maybe collection agencies sometimes overlook when it comes to maximizing the benefits and the returns that can be realized during tax season. Maybe you want to start first, Mike Frost?
Yeah, I think, you know, areas, you know, tax season always starts with, you know, making sure you have probably the right staffing to handle the volumes that you're going to have and the hopefully the increased return calls or right party contacts that you have. One of the things that we've used in the past and oftentimes is helpful instead of overstaffing where you have additional employees that maybe after tax season would have to be released is to utilize overtime. And overtime is actually a really good opportunity both for the agents and for the company because you have most often the best people wanting to have the additional time and opportunity to collect more revenue. So your revenue dollars per agent is probably going to be higher than bringing in a new FTE prior to tax season and then maybe not being fully ramped before you get through that process. So overtime has been a really good opportunity in the past to be able to run that and create some additional dollars over the tax season and also to be able to provide the level of service that's needed through that increased demand. So I think that's first and foremost is making sure that you have the right levels there and the right processes in place to allow to make sure that you have the phones getting answered at the right levels and especially from an impound perspective to generate the revenue that you so desperately need during that time frame. Obviously, the best time of the season to collect for most of us is in that time period. So you have to make the most of it. But I would recommend for people if you're not using overtime as a methodology to increase or the staffing levels, that's something that you could definitely take a look at.
Yeah, this is Hiller. I'll piggyback off that, Mike Frost. That well said. I mean, you look at manufacturing, right? So they add a second shift and they add a third shift. And what did they just do? They just tripled the size of their building without any additional costs. And that's what overtime is as far as proper staffing. But for those of you that do need to hire, a mistake would be, right, back to our theme is don't hire anyone with a pulse. I mean, I know the job market's improved, unemployment's down. That means it's a little tough out there, my air quotes. But I don't care. I don't care if it's tough out there. Don't lower your standards. Establish your standards and your requirements and stick to them. And if that means you got to conduct three times as many interviews, then it is what it is. Another mistake would be, you know, not performing background checks, both criminal and financial. And then shifting gears to tax time, I think was part of that question. What we do is we make sure that all of our accounts are scored and then we throw those scores out the window. I mean, basically income tax returns for many Americans living paycheck to paycheck is forced savings. So we do things differently during income tax time, not the least of which is to almost entirely ignore what the heck the scores are.
Yeah, but following up with that, I think that you have to start early, start your planning in September, refresh your data, whether it's through a score, look at your old accounts that are sitting there that you've had in the shop for a while, you know, get new contact information on them, develop your letter strategies, you know, just don't letter everything because we all know letter's expensive. According to the IRS, 50% of all refunds were issued on or before March 9th this year for 2017. And the average refund was $2,899. So, you know, how much are you going to get out of that refund? You know, how big is the balance? So those are things you have to start thinking about as well.
And I would say that if you're going to send out a tax time letter offering some kind of settlement, number one, make sure that you have your collection notice review attorney review that letter. Sometimes those letters are overlooked because they're not, they're kind of a once in a year type letter. And then the other thing is don't just send them out to every account in your database. You need to be aware of who's getting them and what kind of account is going to get them, because you certainly don't want to send out an initial notice and then a tax time letter offering a settlement 5 days later. So don't make any dumb mistakes like that.
Settlement letter or balance reduction offer letter?
You got it. You got it.
Excellent. Well, we're just about out of time, but before we wrap up, what I'd like to do is maybe go around the panel one more time and have everybody share a takeaway, words of wisdom, any sort of parting thoughts that they want to share either about this topic or just sort of about maybe looking ahead to 2019 as we get ready for the holidays to start, and we can wrap up the webinar that way. LaDonna, would you mind starting?
Sure. Thank you. I guess my best advice or takeaway from this is, you know, trust your peers. You know, we've all done things, you know, some of us have made stupid mistakes, and learn from other people's mistakes. You know, get involved with some information sharing, get in a peer group, you know, join an industry organization, and that's how you're going to grow and mitigate risk and improve things.
Excellent. Thank you. Michael O'Meara?
I guess I'd have two just quick tips that I like to tell folks. One is that your agency should have a list of the consumer protection attorneys that make a living suing our members. That's helpful for a couple of reasons. Collectors should be aware of who's out there so that when they hear those names, they can take appropriate action. And when you get letters from these folks, they're not treated like sort of rank and file attorney letters. They are paid a special attention to. So, you know, there's a list of about 100 consumer protection attorneys. It's not overwhelming, but it's nice to know that those folks are on your radar. The other thing I know is just sort of a reiteration of something somebody already said, but I can't stress it enough. You need to record your phone calls. And if you're not, you should be. You know, a lot of agency owners worry that they're simply sort of gathering a treasure trove of evidence to be used against them. So they're sort of weaving the strands of the rope that's going to be used to hang them. But, you know, other than sometimes finding out that really you're just providing evidence to the plaintiff that there was a technical violation of some kind, there are a lot of good reasons to record. One, you're going to eliminate that sort of he said, she said claims, which your attorney hates because he can't really win that case short of a trial. And that's a very expensive proposition. So if you've got a recording, it might be it might allow you to prevail in a case short of a trial, you know, on a motion for summary judgment or a motion to dismiss. Most importantly, I think you'll be able to sort of rebut the claims of truly heinous, nasty behavior. When a consumer says you were throwing out racial slurs or profanity or making serious threats to their safety, if you've got a recording, you can rebut that, and it does a lot to mitigate any claims of actual damages. And of course, another great reason to do it is you're going to be able to audit those calls to ensure they are, for instance, making disputed files. I know I harped on this quite a bit. That they're marking disputed files disputed. And of course, they're a great training tool. So good calls and bad calls alike provide you with an opportunity to go back to your staff and pat folks on the back or make changes.
Excellent. Thank you. Mike Hiller?
Saving best for last. Okay. All right. I love cliches. They're cliches for a reason. So I would say one of the biggest mistakes on the ops side is not leading by example. You got high standards for your staff, and you should. You expect perfection. That's fine. That doesn't mean you're naive to the fact that mistakes are going to happen. But the point I'm trying to drive home here is treat your staff better than you expect them to treat consumers. I mean, it's a cultural thing, and it's got wide-reaching implications. That doesn't mean don't have high standards. It doesn't mean don't have notice of corrective action and all the things that keeps us compliant. But just think about the things that you do day in and day out, because it will translate from top to bottom to what's transpiring on the phone.
Excellent. Well, actually, I'm leaving Mike Frost for last, because if he's going to go by Frosty and it's the holidays, I kind of felt like he should wrap things up. So, Mike, why don't you take us home?
Well, I appreciate that. And I would just say, you know, it's my kids like to give me peanuts for Christmas. It seems like that's the gift that I get every year. And I think we touched on, you know, if you grab a handful of those peanuts, you've got a whole bucket left of them, right? And that's what we did today. We had one webinar where we got through a handful of issues, talked through them as a group, as, you know, a few peers, and we had participants on the phone. Get involved in the associations next year. Get involved in these webinars. Share information. Work across the industry as a team. That's the only way we're going to make change across the group. So I would just leave with you that is, in the new year, I would love to see everybody get involved, as involved as we can. We're only as good as everybody that is involved, and the lowest rung on that ring. So let's work together to make 2019 a great year, and happy holidays to everyone.
Here, here, here.
You were going to say that you were allergic to peanuts. That's why you're.
Kind of wish I was, because I keep seem to devour them too much.
Excellent. Well, before I let everybody go, I want to thank LaDonna, Mike, and Michael for their insights and their time today. Really appreciate them sharing their expertise with us. I also wanted to thank InterPros for sponsoring today's webinar. Again, you can go to www.interpros.com to learn more about the company. And before I wrap up, I just want to thank everybody who participated. This is the last scheduled webinar I have for 2018. So I just wanted to take a second and thank everybody for their support. I went ahead and counted this morning, and this is the 53rd webinar that I've done in 2018. And looking at all the total number of attendees, we've had more than 4,000 people register and participate this year. And I'm just so overwhelmed by that number. It couldn't be more appreciative of the support that I get from the attendees, from the speakers, and from the sponsors. So on behalf of myself, thank you for that. I hope everybody enjoys the rest of their day. Please stay tuned to accountsrecovery.net for news for the rest of this year and more webinars when we get back from the holidays in 2018. And everybody, before I forget, everybody should be checking out Collector Live, the event that I'm helping, that I'm partnering on, that's coming to a live stream near you on January the 15th. Collector.live is a website for that. So thanks a lot. Happy holidays. Everyone enjoy the rest of the day. Take care.
Been a pleasure. Happy holidays.